Hello and welcome to the brand new platinum edition of Romaniacs podcast. As you might have read last week, Liam Fox paid £107,000 for a business podcast that consisted of six episodes and got a grand total of 8,300 listeners. Apparently, this is now the going rate. So we got on to Dr. Fox's Department for International Trade for some of that sweet podcast money. And now we're recording on platinum microphones in a floating studio in the Caribbean, and the non-vegan cast members are chuffing down their swan burgers. I'm Naomi Smith, and I've got some of our regulars here. Hello, Ros Taylor of the Truth, Trust and Technology Commission. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Would you listen to Liam Fox's podcast? Did you listen to it?
I didn't before, but I have now. Well, I started anyway, and I just got through the first 5 minutes of an episode. It was a bloke banging on about how he exports beard products.
Beard?
And, yeah, beard. He was explaining that he has a lovely beard himself, and he wanted to share this joy with the world. And So there was a lot of beard stuff, and then I'm afraid I fell asleep because I was kind of using it as an alternative to my normal app that sends me to sleep. So, anyway. But the big thing with this, isn't it, is it not that it's insane to bring out a podcast about encouraging people to export when you're just about to totally shake up and change the way all the rules work for exporting? So no one knows, has any certainty about it, anything.
I mean, it's exactly that kind of thick of it conversation you can imagine going on. Like, we must have a podcast. Yes, yes, let's budget for one. And then somebody saying, yeah, what is a podcast after they've already budgeted for it? We've also got actor, comedian, writer and director Ingrid Oliver here. Hello, Ingrid.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm feeling very fighty today.
Good, because we've not been on a show together for ages.
We haven't, you know, we really haven't. I'm wearing leopard print, so I mean business
rawr
today. Brexit business. Rawr. Yeah.
Yeah. Why is Chris Grayling still in post?
Do you know what? Do these people have no shame? That is what I would ask. I have no idea. Well, we do have some idea. He's a really good friend. He's been a really good friend to Theresa.
Exactly.
So he's worth £2.7 million pounds worth of friendship. It's Brexit, if anything, has just done wonders for my imposter syndrome. If ever I think I'm not good enough.
Just look
at a picture of Chris Grayling.
You should
have like an Instagram account with motivational quotes just superimposed on pictures of Chris Grayling's face, going, "You are enough," or "Dare to fail."
There was this amazing correction in the New York Times. I don't know if people saw it. It said, because of an editing error, an earlier version of this article misstated the amount that a Labour Party report claimed Chris Grayling's misadventures had cost British taxpayers. It is £2.7 billion, not £2.7 million. I mean, the orders of magnitude of fuck-up are just ever-increasing with him. Will little children, do you think, in the future be saying, yeah, but Chris Grayling, to their teachers and parents when they cock up? I mean, have we got to those levels? Is he now just a meme of himself?
I mean, and I'd like to think that children would know who Chris Grayling was. Because in Germany we have these fairy tales, like really sinister figures who stop you from doing things, like Struwwelpeter, who's one that has, I don't know if you know him, Shockheaded Peter. So Chris Grayling could be like a Germanic, nightmarish fairy tale figure that stops children overreaching.
Completing our team this week is our new regular guest that we're delighted is here. Melissa Chaumont is a French journalist, broadcaster, and she specialises in migration issues. But she's also a music writer whose new book, Massive Attack, Out of the Comfort Zone, is out this week. Welcome back to Romaniacs, Melissa. How are you?
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm great. I've been going to a lot of non-Brexiting places recently.
Oh, you lucky thing.
Including Paris. This still exists over there. And Glasgow and Bristol recently, as you said, just for the launch of that book this weekend.
Oh, fantastic. So Massive Attack are pretty pro-Euro, aren't they? There was a track on the Protection album called Eurochild, and they had a sort of strange bulbous mascot with EU stars all over it.
Indeed.
Did you ever fathom what that was all about?
Yeah, of course. I mean, good pick on that song. Actually, they played that song on July 1st, just after the referendum, when it happened. So, hey guys, we're here, this band, where everyone's an immigrant. Thank you very much. We're also touring the world, and especially Europe, and our tour is starting tomorrow, so great. And And so that song was like the national anthem for the summer 2016. It's an interesting one because the lyrics are all about, it was written when actually the European Union tried to become more political and more about a union than just trading stuff. And they were like, on our perspective in the UK, people don't seem to believe in that. So is it going to go very well? And so the lyrics are very Massive Attack-y, quite of paranoid. And when I talked about it with the guys for the book, they were like, "We're so sorry we predicted it. We're really sorry. We love Europe." Actually, one of the band member is Italian himself. Yeah. They have a strong link with places like Southern Italy or Paris or Portugal, Spain. Mm. And they loved in Poland and stuff like that. So you kind of missing an opportunity there to reconcile with the rest of us.
Absolutely. And sort of speaking about immigration and immigrants producing wonderful things. Do we think that Britain is changing its mind about immigration? Do you get any sense as a migration specialist that, you know, some of the polls are showing it's just not the issue for British voters that it once was? Do you sense that actually we
still regret? Yeah, definitely, because, you know, I've been living here on and off for 10 years because I was based in London 10 years ago, then I moved to Africa, I came back, and I always found that it was one of the most tolerant places I've ever been to, because before then I was living in Miami, so you can imagine the difference. Mm-hmm. And when the referendum came up and some media used migration as a tool to foster hatred, like we can see everywhere. We can see that in Europe, obviously, as well, in Hungary, and we've seen that in France too. But then it was working for a while. But no, I think it's just, we've seen the recent polls, so I've read it into the BBC. People were quite not keen to say why this has changed, but it's obvious that in 2011, people were quoting new immigrants coming in as something negative, and they are not doing it anymore. I think the debate, and what I thought was very positive about this referendum and the consequences, because they are, then we must find some positive stuff, is that people had to look back at some of their beliefs, right? And when you live in London, or when you live in some of the other massive city in the country, there are so many people doing the jobs that, you know, British people don't want to do or cannot do, like nurses, teachers for this and that, driving the bus, or, you know, when you're in London, you hear more of European accents than British accents in most restaurants, bars, you know, clubs. So, you know, I don't think these people are doing any harm.
I know. And it was always the case that you were much more likely to be treated by an immigrant than behind one in a queue for a public service. So,
well, so it's been a long story, right? Before Europeans, it was like the Caribbean people. And before then, you know, we had the empire and you could move people the way you wanted. Now people have been trying to move the way they want. And it's become a little bit more challenging with Brexit.
We'll be talking about all of that and more on this week's show. We're going to be looking at the calm before next week's storm, which brings 3 days of meaningful votes, amendments and horse trading, all of which could result in assent for May's deal, an OK for her deal, plus a ratification referendum, or no deal at all. We will also be covering what's happening in terms of last-minute trade-offs, are Labour or the ERG weakening, and can Theresa May bribe enough Labour MPs into backing Brexit? Spoiler alert, no. Plus, Ladies Who Leave, the frankly bizarre video by Esther McVeigh and friends. Will it persuade women to back Brexit? We don't think so. Why now, and who are all those women anyway? And the prospect of the UK holding EU elections is becoming increasingly real. They might have to happen, but who will stand, who will vote, and will it amount to a de facto referendum if it happens? All of this and more after some reminders from Roz.
Life's all well and good in the self-confirming elite bubble that is the Remainersphere, but if you want to get out of your comfort zone, come and see Remainiacs at the podcast's live Politics Day in London on Sunday the 7th of April. Me and regulars Dorian Linsky, Nina Schick and Alex Andreu will be live on stage at this new one-day festival of politics podcasts, including The Week Unwrapped, Ian Dale and Jackie Smith's For the Many, Red Box from The Times, Samira Ahmed's How I Found My Voice, and, if you really want to mix your drinks, James Dellingpole's Dellingpod. It's happening at The Light, opposite Euston Station, and tickets are on sale now at podcastlive.com. Patreon supporters get a discount on day tickets, as well as tickets to the Remainiacs show. And if you're not backing us on Patreon yet, it's a good time to sign up. You'll get discounts on live tickets, our very desirable merchandise, and, if you're on the $5 tier or upwards, our new monthly Ask Remainiacs show. The latest one is out now. Search Patreon Remainiacs or go to our Facebook page to find out more. And that's podcastslive.com for tickets to Podcast Live, hence the name.
Thanks, Roz. Now, who's up for piping hot cup of Brexit news? Firstly, the week before, the big week that's going to settle everything, allegedly. As we wait to see what shape the final votes will take, there are already shifts in some of the basic positions. Attorney General Geoffrey Cox is said to have abandoned some key demands on the backstop. The ERG may be softening on their implacable opposition to May's deal. Labour's supposed commitment to a people's vote is suddenly looking a bit wobbly again. And Theresa May thinks she can solve it all by offering a Brexit bribe to wavering Labour MPs. Let's start with that Brexit bribe. Theresa May unveiled her Stronger Towns Fund, offering £1.6 billion over 6 years, only for David Lammy to point out that the European Social and Regional Development Fund put in £9.34 billion over the same period. And she was rebuffed by a spread of Labour MPs, including Brexiteer Gloria Del Piero, who said, "This is peanuts compared to what we have lost." Roz, it's just a bit too late to open this chequebook, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, given that so much of Brexit was driven by austerity, it's pretty ironic that this is happening now. And of course, the European Social Fund and Regional Development, that's only a part of the money that towns will have lost, because they've lost an awful lot thanks to the cuts to councils. Some councils now have had their budgets cut to nothing, their central government budgets cut to nothing. And so the idea that they will compensate for that is extraordinary. It's also worth pointing out that this is only England. Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland, there is nothing for those, and there is kind of vague talk that maybe in the future this money will be matched, but really, will it?
And it isn't that sort of more proof to the pudding that it definitely is a bribe, because she's focused it on areas where there are Labour MPs representing Leave constituencies that she thinks she can bring over. If she'd spread it out more, it may be slightly more plausible that it wasn't a bribe.
Yeah, and it doesn't really seem to have worked very well. The only Labour MP I saw who was pro it was John Mann of Bassett Law, and he already voted for Theresa May's deal. So that's not somebody who's been brought over. That's somebody who was already on side. So it really doesn't look like it's working.
So would she have just been in a better position if she'd done nothing at all, do you think? Do you think it's actively hurt her? Do you think there are some that may have been persuaded that now think, well...
I think it's hardened opposition, and it's also drawing attention to the fact that these towns do need the money, which is not necessarily what she wants to do.
Mm. Ingrid, what does this say about how the government sees the Brexit voting areas and their MPs? I mean, it's sort of quite damning, isn't it?
Well, yes, as an irritant, I suppose. It's something that has to be dealt with. And it's for a party that for years has sort of said, you know, councils need to raise their own money and not rely on handouts from central government, it does seem slightly cynical, to say the least. It's interesting, you know, MPs like Lisa Nandy, who has said, yeah, we'll take it, thanks very much, but it doesn't mean that we're going to vote for the deal. So it seems like, I mean, if she's hoping to buy off MPs, I don't think that's going to happen. She's been so cynical throughout the whole process that the idea that handing over a few notes is going to suddenly make people change their mind.
It worked for DUP.
Did it? Yeah, because they always vote with her. I think it's also the idea that, you know, If Labour MPs were to just go, right, well, we'll vote with the deal, that trade-off is then that they have sort of, they've neglected their duty on things like workers' rights, which if May gets her deal through, that's probably going to be one of the things that goes. So it would be very hard-pressed for a Labour MP to vote for the deal, but on the basis of, a couple of quid.
Melissa, what about in France? Do you think this sort of pork barrel politics could work there?
Well, I don't think it could work. It could definitely exist. I mean, it's the same over there. You know, some politicians have always used the European Union as, you know, the evil, everything that's wrong about politics come from there. But we even had some candidates who campaigned for Frexit. I don't know if you've heard of them, because they haven't been as successful as Mr. Farage. But François Asselineau still has like some of his posters in like neglected areas of Paris, you know, near the périphérique where people never clean the walls. And of course, Marine Le Pen has gained a lot of voters through hating the European Union. And we know that she's an MEP and she's misused the money. So it's like, you know, I mean, it's exactly the same story. It's just we're lucky that I think in France, a lot of people don't see the EU in the same way at all. I mean, we are like one of the founding members, and the EU wouldn't exist without France, Germany, and probably Belgium and the Netherlands. So it's just used by, it's not as much efficient. It's a topic that comes back with Les Gilets Jaunes, you know, all the protests, the yellow vests they're called here. Mm. They obviously decry the new, I mean, the trend to privilege big business. Mm. And the EU was for years and years based on like the agriculture policy, mm. which was a good thing for France or yes. Poland mm. because we were agricultural countries. But now with agribusiness, everything has changed. So agriculture started the movement with the Gilets Jaunes, but they are suffering. They're not taking care of the land or what they're mm. planting anymore. They're just used by the big system. Mm. So it's complicated for them to just thank the EU, even though they're still pouring money in rural zones. But luckily for now, it's not become like such a battle on a political field. It's just used by the very extreme right.
So we don't think it's going to work, but is that because of where she's targeting? Are there other areas that it could have worked? Should she have tried to bring in some of the, I don't know, areas in like the southwest? I don't think there's much earmarked for the northeast.
No, there's not. And also, quite a lot of the money has to be bid for, which will naturally go to councils.
About 600 million of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a reasonable amount that mm. that has to be bid for. And that basically will go to councils that have got their act together more and mm. have the time, because it costs money to put in bids. And no, I was surprised actually by how little went mm. to the southwest. And I was also surprised that nothing had gone to Wales, because mm. Wales did vote to leave narrowly, but it did vote to leave. And it is an area with a lot of deprivation. Mm.
Yes, I mean, I'm sure that that's partly why they get quite a bit of EU funding already, is because some of the wards in Wales are amongst the poorest in Northern
yeah.
Europe.
And it's not just South Wales, and you think of the ex-mining areas mm. as well. It's also West Wales mm. Has a lot of deprivation, and the north coast as well.
Mm, mm, mm. And nothing for them at all. Let's move on now, because we've also got Labour's promise of backing a public vote. So it was a week ago that we saw the leadership of the Labour Party sort of change its plan and say, actually, now we probably are happy to back a second referendum if her deal is voting down. That's beginning to attract some cynicism. Roz, you're pretty wary of Corbyn's commitment to stopping Brexit. Do you think everybody was wrong to be very excited about that U-turn last week?
I think everyone got a bit overexcited, and that was understandable.
Was it just to disarm the Tiggers, do you think? Is that what,
yes.
what his shot was?
I think that's what it was to do. And I think the plan is to ensure that the Labour leadership can say, oh, well, we did have a vote, but it didn't go our way. We did, demand a vote in the Commons on a second referendum, but we didn't win it. And the reason why they won't win it is because a number of Labour MPs are implacably opposed to the idea of a second referendum. They've been quite vocal about that, people like Caroline Flint, and they will not change their minds. In fact, some of them claim, Caroline Flint claims, up to 70 Labour MPs are opposed to a people's vote. So I think the strategy here, and I think unfortunately it was a strategy, was to promise something and to let the leadership off the hook. But ultimately, although John McDonnell has said he will whip Labour MPs, there are whips and there are whips. And there is no way, given that a lot of Labour MPs defied the whip in voting for Theresa May's deal in the first place, there is no way that they will automatically vote for a people's vote just because mm. they've been told to.
Mm. So, Melissa, this Kyle Wilson amendment, which is basically will back your deal as long as you put it back to the people, do you think there's a risk that you know, as what Roz is sort of saying, that the leadership can take credit for saying, yes, we support that and whip for its MPs to back it, but that whip is so loose and it isn't really, you know, the backbenchers don't fear it, that actually if they abstain or vote against it,
yeah,
I
totally believe that nothing is firm enough in that case. But I mean, it's so late. I think we know that most of the Labour voters or Labour supporters or Labour members as such are vastly pro-Remain, mm, right? Mm. So there was no campaign because of Labour on the side of Remain, almost, because it was so, you know, lukewarm about saying that they support staying, and maybe they had a bad strategy, maybe they didn't see things coming, maybe they don't read the right newspaper, I don't know what it is. But I think now the people's vote is one thing, that a lot of people are in favour of it, because it's like the only thing that seems like can have a meaning, I mean, can be done and be done properly. Maybe if there are three options, for instance, that some people could take, at least avoid the mess or remain, and then people could express themselves a second time. I hate the fact that some people can say it's not democratic. Obviously, if you vote, it's
democratic,
right? They are democratic. You vote for the UMP every 5 years. I think Labour has been just willing to be in power. And I think they're wrong in the sense that they want to fight austerity. But because austerity is what the Tories have been able to just throw massively because of Brexit, it makes no sense, like, to say we'll be the saviour if we were elected and if we were in government. But no one wants you in government. At the moment, we don't know what you promise. So.
And what are you going to fight it with?
Exactly.
If you tank the economy
because
of Brexit.
They live a bit in a different like dimension, according to me, because the way they want to fight austerity or the economy, as it's put as such, is not related to what's actually happening. Like, if you lose a lot of jobs, if you lose a lot of people investing in this country, and how are you going to help? How are you get more taxes? How are you going to get more people employed and satisfied? And then you have, like, the human rights effects of all these people being in limbo, like all the foreigners. So I don't see how that could help Labour. So I don't know. They should really come back with something that sounds at least a little hopeful.
I certainly think that from our work at Better Britain, we know that the leadership are probably pretty firm on next week's votes, and it is the backbenchers in the north of England, particularly a few in the Midlands, who are the worrisome ones. This morning, actually, Poplar and Limehouse MP Jim Fitzpatrick did say that he would vote for her deal come what may, but he has sort of always said that and did vote for it the last time. So again, that's not one she's won, but there are these ones that we are a bit concerned about. The ones she's tried to bribe, most of them have rejected that bribe. But if anybody is listening to this show and lives in one of those seats, please do make sure that you're ramping up the pressure on the MP. But in terms of Labour Party politics, Ingrid, this is all happening against the backdrop of other internal warfare that's not just about Brexit happening within the party. Obviously, all of the anti-Semitism stuff. We've had the suspension of Chris Williamson. So has stopping Brexit become permanently entwined with centrists among the Corbyn faithful? And are they sort of therefore just rejecting it all as Tom Watson and the Tiggers on manoeuvres, and they just can ignore it?
I mean, the anti-Semitism thing is a separate issue from Brexit to a certain extent. And it's one that I feel quite emotional about, actually. I'm so appalled at what's happening currently and how it's being dealt with in the Labour Party. I mean, say what you will, and, you know, the Tories sacking 14 Tory members for Islamophobia, that's almost certainly, it's a PR stunt in the sense they go, look, we've done that, we've dealt with it. Whereas Labour in two years have sacked 12 fewer for anti-Semitism. So, I mean, that wasn't the point I was going to make, but Brexit has taught me a lot about politics in the last couple of years, which is that if you have a strong enough message, a core message that people who want to believe in you can get behind, like, you know, take back control, or for the many, not the few, if you're then attacked, you know, if people say, oh, you're an anti-Semitic party, or you're not dealing with Brexit very well, you can then go, oh, Do you not believe that poor people should be saved, or do you not believe in helping people in poverty, the most needy in our society? Because if you attack the Jeremy Corbyn, that's what you're doing to his supporters. You're attacking poor people.
If you're not with us,
anti-Semitism and accusations that they're not being very good on Brexit, it's all part of some bigger strategy to stop Jeremy Corbyn getting into power, and it's just, you know. So it becomes, and with Brexit, it's become, like with the anti-Semitism thing, it's become, that if you align yourself with people that sort of accuse the leader's office, then you are a certain kind of person. And that, I think, is probably something that Corbyn has and his team have used to their advantage. It hasn't hurt them.
What I have been spurred on by this week has been, and actually last week, but I don't know if you saw yesterday, there were a group of Labour MPs who unveiled a Love Socialism, Hate Brexit banner. And they're very firmly on the left of the Labour Party. So these are people like Lloyd Russell-Moyle and Chiemwera. And they are, you know, saying all the right things and beginning to emerge and take ownership of all of this themselves. So I think that's pretty positive. They are certainly trying to flex their muscle against anti-Semitism and stop Brexit.
Yeah.
Do you feel that maybe he is beginning to feel that the power within the party is shifting towards some of those younger MPs like Clive Lewis? And
I don't know is the answer to that. I would like to. I'd like to be positive about it. But because I have sympathy with Labour MPs, because because it's very hard to know what to do on Brexit, because they have they haven't had a coherent strategy from the leadership's office, and they want to. You know, I imagine some MPs do believe inherently that they should deliver the vote, the result of the referendum, or that they should avoid no deal. So voting for May's deal, I suppose, is the way that they can ensure that. But what, from a Remainers point of view, if we lived in a sort of fantasy land, what could Labour have done, do you think?
Well, certainly where we've seen some Labour MPs who have taken a position opposed to their constituency vote in 2016, they've actually been able to shift it. They've shown leadership, and actually their constituents, far from, I mean, obviously you always get some mouth frothers, you know, being terrible towards you over it, but actually they've been able to take their constituents with them, and they've been able to act in that leadership position that we've needed them to, and to be able to have a very honest conversation with their constituents about, hey, I know that it was a kickback, I know it was against a coalition government and a Tory-led government. I know you weren't kicking back against me, but trust me, it's the jobs that are going to be hurt here. This isn't the way to fix all of the problems that we're facing. So I guess I wish they would have all just been a bit more brave and had the courage of their convictions, because very few of them are actual leavers.
Yeah.
The killer has surely been that Labour has aligned itself with the Conservatives' hard Brexit all along. And OK, we had a shift on the customs union. Doesn't make a lot of difference. Basically, it's very hard for an opposition to criticise the government when it shares its vision of what Brexit should look like.
So one area where Labour probably do diverge, Roz, from the Conservative Party is on the whole issue of Ireland and the backstop. Horrible to put you on the spot with this, such an enormous issue, but it, you know, in a couple of sentences, where are we right now with the backstop?
Well, the backstop is basically a way to avoid a hard border in Northern Ireland, and where we are now is fundamentally to see whether there can be a time limit on the backstop, because that is what the DUP were demanding basically this morning. They were saying they would probably be okay with a deal that meant there was a time limit on it. And the EU, understandably in my view, are not playing ball, because they say, well, what would change to make us allow you to have a time limit? We would need to know what was going to be in place so that the whole arrangement could end.
Indeed. And ever so quickly, Melissa, on time limits and the EU being very reasonable about extending things, if next week her deal does get voted down, and then on Wednesday the Commons vote on an extension, regardless of whether they vote for it or not, if they do vote for it, the EU still has to agree it. What are the chances?
I think they're next to zero. I mean, seriously, Northern Ireland is completely underestimated over here, but it's one of the main issues. I don't think it's possible. I mean, there are a lot, people don't realise how complicated it is for the rest of the EU. It's just, it would be the main border, just like Poland and Ukraine is the main border on the other side. So they have to be firm.
Yeah.
It has to be. I think they're closer to suggesting give back Northern Ireland to Ireland than anything else.
but just on the actual giving us an extension on Article 50, do you think they would be open to that if we didn't tell them what it was for,
Donald Tusk has been quite vocal about this, is ready to give them more time, but they have to sound like they know what they're doing and what they're asking
for. With that time, rather than just more meaningless votes.
And then, of course, there's the European elections looming in. If you
Indeed.
Want to have the extension, you have to organise elections for at least, I guess, the Europeans to vote here to probably elect British MPs as well.
Indeed. And we are going to come on to that. But before we do, ladies who leave, ladies, not women, ladies, something even that makes even less sense than quantum Brexitology. There was this very strange video in which Esther McVeigh and other female Brexiters tried to recast leave as a feminist issue, which is funny because most of their talking points, men dominating TV coverage in the referendum run-up, men writing and presenting the majority of print and radio content on Brexit, were pretty much identical to those raised by women against Brexit. for more details, please go to bestforbritain.com/sexist-Brexit, where you can find out exactly why Brexit is a feminist issue, or not a feminist issue. But with depressing inevitability, it turns out that one of the ladies is a Pendle councillor who got in trouble for making racist jokes. Mum of four, Belinda DeLucy, turned out to have a husband who's in private equity. And another one was, you know, podcast favourite, Julia Hartless Brewer. Ingrid, what do you make against Ladies for Leave?
Do you know, I've just got a noise or a duh. I can't. I'm so. I watched that video and I. It just speaks. Every fibre in my body went into revolt, and I think things like the mum of four, Belinda DeLucy, the idea that she's a mum of four. She can't lie to you. She's a mum of four. She wants the best for her kids. She's a mum of four. She's a trustworthy. She's a mum of four. That's who she is.
Yeah. Can't trust a mum of three.
She loves kids. She's had four of them, and it just, which to me is that it immediately goes against the idea that it's a feminist issue. But also the fact that her husband's in private equity. It's like, I want to leave because for my kids and so that my husband can deregulate the economy and we can make loads of money. I also, the fact that their sort of figurehead is Esther McVeigh, who willfully misled Parliament and didn't resign. The fact that that's their figurehead, I mean, that is really scraping the barrel. I think she mentions the word trust about 20 times in that video. the have they no shame? That is my refrain for today. Have they no shame? The irony completely lost on them, clearly. But also, I looked at it, I was like, that is not a well-produced video, but then maybe that's the point.
Yeah.
It makes me think that the Best for Britain video that I directed, with you, that was... I should have just stuck people in a toilet and just turned a camera on them and have done.
I think it probably is purposely downhill because they've used the Tesco Value logo and repurposed
it's
it.
It's so cynical. I can't bear it. Yeah. She's called Belinda DeLucy, for goodness sake.
Yeah, well, and then
she's never been
Julia
near a Tesco.
Hartley Brewer, you know, they're all double-barreled plummy ladies. I mean, the tone is absolutely great. Julia did say, Brexiteers aren't all old white men, you know. They include us ladies as well. And Mum of Four, as you say, Belinda DeLucy, says, retweet if you think our children's votes should matter. But, you know... sod all the children who didn't get to vote last time and whose futures are being taken away from them. So the pool seems pretty limited. They're all pretty posh. I think we've established that. They have got a token non-white person, but they do turn up in this and every Leave.eu video. Are we just doing that standard sneery Remainer thing, though, Roz? I mean, should we just accept them on face value or argue against them rather than ridiculing them?
Well,
it is tempting to ridicule them.
As a mum of two...
So you're only half as trustworthy as Belinda.
No. It's difficult for me because I instinctively don't like political campaigns that appeal directly to one sex or the other. And usually it's the women to whom they appeal. And I say this about the anti-Brexit movement as well. I just don't like it. I don't like the fact, for example, that in the run-up to the referendum, Leave EU targeted its NHS adverts online exclusively at women. Because, you know, it's only women who care about the NHS because we're all so caring. Mm. Whereas, in fact, just as many men die. It's bizarre.
And didn't Labour's pink bus go really badly a few years ago? Was it Harriet Harman's pink bus, was it? Was it one of the...
I didn't enjoy it. But the thing I hated about this video was the whole kind of Women's Institute chumminess about it. Mm. It was all, and I don't like to slag off the Women's Institute because I hear they're a very modern, gorgeous organisation now that does a lot more than just make jam. But it was just, ladies, are your ears burning? Because ours are. And it was like listening to a couple of women chatting in the loo. Because I suppose I thought about this because of the ladies as well. A couple of women chatting in the loo. And you think, you know, you sometimes overhear a couple of women chatting in the loo and you think, oh, my God, what are they saying? Oh, this is embarrassing. Oh, my God. I just have to get out of this loo very quickly. And that was how I felt.
Can I just say that they only have 2,640 followers, I checked this morning. My dentist has more. So, as in, I don't think they've made a huge impact, to be fair.
Great.
Follow them just for sort of amusement purposes.
Is your dentist a Remainer?
I do not know. Ooh. Oh, I should find out.
Yeah, don't let him in your mouth.
No, God, no.
It was just identity politics at its worst because it was just saying, oh, we're women, listen to us because we're women. In that short video, they didn't actually explain any of the reasons why it was important that women's voices be heard, what they were saying, what they wanted to do. It was just, listen to us. And I find that so boring.
I think one of the reasons why they may have timed it now is because all of the research that we've done is showing that the fastest switching groups from believed to remain are younger women, and they're particularly ones who voted Conservative in 2015 and Labour in 2017, aged sort of between 20 and 50. They're switching in their droves towards Remain, so they're probably good. Reacting against that. So just, you know, quick poll around the podcast studio. What do we prefer, Ladies Who Leave or, drum roll, Nigel Farage's 200-mile march to leave from Sunderland to London? Melissa?
It's a tough one, because I didn't got to say how much I disliked the previous video, but can have a plan B. Everyone has a plan B on everything. I want a plan B on that question. Yeah, not good. I don't know, but... Nigel Farage is trying to hang on, I guess, you know. Everyone is trying to reinvent themselves at the moment on this issue. Let these ladies express themselves, but it's just, it's not the way forward, definitely. Don't tell people what you think they should think, et cetera, et cetera. If women can express themselves, there'll be as many women as many other voters, and there's no need to represent them. So it's all manipulation, both of this.
It's interesting. There was a Mumsnet discussion about people's vote earlier this week with Caroline Criado Perez, and it bombed, actually. It didn't go well at all because it came across as patronising, because it came across as one woman trying to tell loads of other women what they think and why they should think it, and why Brexit is bad on those issues, when I think a lot of their readers are women on maternity leave who identify more as businesswomen and lawyers and nurses and doctors than they do necessarily about, you know, the very sort of singular issues around women's rights post-Brexit and whether they're at threat.
I reckon Nigel is just jealous, because he's seen how many Remainers turn out, nearly 750,000 on their march, and now he wants to do something similar in his own march.
Before we move on, everyone in Britain loves elections. We can't get enough of them, especially Brenda from Bristol. Not another one! But hold tight, because we may well be participating in the 2019 European elections on the 23rd of May, and Ian, Dorian and Alex are down the Electoral Commission as we record, getting their candidate forms in. As we've discussed on the show before, if our exit from the EU is delayed, it means we'd still be a member when the elections happen, and unless we take part in the EU Parliament itself, it could be effectively unconstitutional. Stephen Kinnock MP, a big fan of Common Market 2.0, insists we can only hold a second referendum if we take part in the 23rd of May European Parliament elections. While May says us participating in the European elections would make a mockery of the referendum. Obviously, I have my position on this, but let's war game it. What is going to happen? Are the Tories and Labour going to run candidates? Roz.
I think they have to. It's going to be very difficult to bring it all together and bring it all together fast enough. It's going to be an extraordinary effort. But basically, the trouble is, if you don't run the candidates, you will get the far right, you will get UKIP or whatever Nigel Farage's new party is running candidates. And because of the way turnout works, people will vote for those. Other people will abstain because there's nothing to vote for. And you'll get those people being elected. So you have to have a wide range of candidates. Otherwise, it'll be a shit show, basically.
And on what platform do they run? I mean, obviously, Conservatives are probably, you know, quite obviously would be running on a pro-Brexit platform. Melissa, what do you think about Labour?
Well, that's quite tricky. But it's absolutely necessary. I think everyone should run. I think Labour has a few hours to kind of change their mind and be up front. If you want what's best for the country, I mean, there's so many issues at stake. And also we know that these elections are they're very key for the future of Europe, but also very key for the futures of, like, you know, extremism in a lot of countries. We've seen that because a lot of people don't take the MEPs as seriously as their own MPs, they tend to vote for more extreme. Also, it's a more proportional vote, etc. So you have to be involved. And then let's not forget that whatever happens with the extension, we're still in a phase where there's supposed to be 2 years of negotiation to actually decide how the UK is actually going to retreat from the EU. Even if it takes place like this spring, there's still more discussions to go. And we've seen that there's 2 years have not been enough to decide on anything. So this might take 10 years. So do you really want to have like a really cool platform where you only have like fake MPs or the main parties are not involved or they have not campaigned again. And for Labour, who, as we said before, has not been really strong in its message during the referendum campaign. And if there is another vote, the people's vote for the referendum for Brexit itself, then, you know, it's all related. Mm. You have to, I think, that, I don't know why nobody's talking about it.
Can I ask a very, what might be stupid question, which is that Theresa May said she doesn't want that to happen. She doesn't want there to be elections because of the message it was sent to the electorate. Can she stop people fielding candidates? Or does it have to be a directive from government that parties are allowed to stand for European elections?
Good question. No, I don't think she can block it. But at the moment, we aren't participating because we will have left on the 29th of March 2019.
If there's an extension,
but if there is an agreed extension to that, I think she couldn't, no. And the Electoral Commission have certainly budgeted for running European elections. That was released under an FOI last year. They've had to ring fence money for that. So all of the infrastructure is in place. I know that the Liberal Democrats, for instance, have been selecting all of their candidates up and down the country over the last 6 months in anticipation. And of course, we saw the independent group go to the Electoral Commission yesterday, Tuesday of this week that we're recording, to register themselves as a political party. So I wonder if that's to make sure that they're in time for the cutoff date for that. What I'm not entirely sure is what that cutoff date is with in terms of the European side of it, whether you have to have been registered by a certain time. It's usually at least 6 weeks before polling day.
Yes, but I don't think the one government as such can prevent the elections from happening, or there are some candidates to register for it. We should check constitutionally.
Are you tempted?
To run, to stand? I hadn't thought about
but
it.
But now,
But I mean, presumably, it is interesting, isn't it? So if an extension was voted for, we'd have a situation where presumably the Lib Dems and, as you say, maybe the Independent Group or the Greens would field candidates. Because our producer is holding up a phone case with Romaniacs on it. You're saying we should form our
field
own political
Romaniacs
group.
Romaniacs candidates.
Field Romaniacs candidates, brilliant.
Or we could be like the Labour and Co-op Party. So, you know, when Labour candidates who are also co-op members stand for election, they are standing as both the Labour and co-op. So so people could be Lib Dem, Labour, Conservative, even if they're people like Anna Soubry or whoever, and they could be and Romaniacs.
Brilliant.
So we could be registered and they could be identified and they could run on that ticket. So it was very identifiable on the ballot paper as to who was
I feel new mugs coming on.
Can I just ask a sort of slightly sombre question about it? As sort of liberal metropolitan elites who eulogise about the wonders of the EU and an open society, what happens if there is a huge swing towards populist candidates getting elected across Europe and all of a sudden after the European elections in May, it looks like a very different kind of EU to the one that we've long been championing and selling to people as this wonderful thing, and it actually looks like a bit of a monstrous place. What do we think about that, Melissa?
What a nightmare. Oh, God. As if we didn't have enough problems. It's a possibility. I mean, you've read probably the op-ed from the French president, Emmanuel Macron, published this week in most of Europe's newspapers. So everyone's worried because, again, these elections are not as covered as the national elections. So obviously all the candidates who could, I mean, there's Nigel Farage and Marine Le Pen are MEPs. So what do you say? Like Ingrid, it's always been my dream to be an MEP. Like, I love politics, but it's difficult to be into politics when you're a journalist. So MEP was kind of like the safe place. Mm-hmm. But this year is a tough one. So it will take a lot of like engagement from the parties, from the press, to actually take it seriously for a change. It's a huge challenge, but what you mentioned can happen, and then we'll be in an even bigger disaster, because after that will come like important elections in some key countries as well, and then it might just be, you know, a ball and chain and just a downward spiral effect. But let's not go there. Let's remain optimistic.
You never know, it might go the other way.
Yeah,
I think people have been watching quite closely what's been happening here and happening in the US, and you might just find a surge of people going, you know what, not in my name, no more,
exactly.
Thank you.
Exactly, just like the march has proved, and there's another march in a few weeks.
Yes.
So,
and of course, Europeans can vote in European elections. So the EU's 27 nationals living in the UK can vote in European elections. So that's great. And for a change, they are being enfranchised. So hopefully they'll turn out in force this time too.
And even if the populists do sweep the board, it will take a while to dismantle all the things that we know and love about Europe. Freedom of movement, for example, and the pillars of Europe. They are fundamentally liberal pillars and they are based around open society. And we've got to hope that, as with Donald Trump in the US and his ability to dismantle the things that make American democracy good, in 4 years, or hopefully they will remain intact. And I hope the same thing happens if populists get elected to the European Parliament.
Hear, hear. This episode of Romaniacs comes with the support of an old friend of the podcast, beer52.com, the world's most popular craft beer discovery club. The way Brexit is heading, we strongly suspect you'd quite like a free case of lovely craft beer. And the good news is we've got one for every listener. Just go to beer52.com/remain to claim yours, and all you pay for is next day shipping. Every month, Beer 52 seeks out intriguing beers from up-and-coming craft brewers with a different theme every time. For all you rugby fans out there, this month's theme is inspired by the Six Nations. With Beer 52's Rugby Nation case, you can try amazing craft beers from each of the six competitors' greatest breweries. There's England's 5-point juicy pale ale, an incredible New England IPA from Italy called Aura, and Ireland's White Hag Little Fawn Session IPA, and lots more too. They're very tempting, great value, and they don't rely on an imaginary Chris Grayling ferry to get here. So that's beer52.com. Every month you get 8 craft beers, plus Ferment magazine and a free snack too. If you like dark beers, get the mixed case. If you prefer lighter beers, choose the light case. Dead easy. Romaniacs listeners can try a first case of 8 incredible craft beers for free. You pay just £5.95 for next day shipping. There's no minimum commitment. You can just take the free case if you want, and you can pause or cancel at any time. So go to beer52.com/remain to claim yours. That's beer52.com/remain. New customers only. Full terms at beer52.com/terms. Regular listeners know that the worse it gets out there, the more we fight like Alan Partridge to keep it light. And that means the Daft Question, where every week or so we rest our eyes off the news ticker to think about Brexit-related matters in another way. The Daft Question for this week is, which figure from the other side would you like to turn and convert to the cause of Remain? And what bloody use would they be? The only rule is you can't have Boris Johnson because he barely believes in Brexit anyway. Melissa, who have you chosen?
Well, I've chosen Jeremy Corbyn, so okay, officially he's not for leave, right? Uh-huh. He never said he was for leave, but I think he was one of the key player that should have been supporting Remain. I know why he doesn't like the European Union, and I can understand that sometimes we have opinions, etc. But you have a lot of responsibility. You're the leader of a party. The party has a message. Obviously, he's been the weakness in this whole campaign. I mean, a lot of people have been doing things maybe too weakly. But if he could finally understand that he's not protecting any workers' right, or he's not talking directly to the heart of West Yorkshire by being like this kind of flaky figure, not knowing what to see, I think you should think about the future and you know, do we really want to be all scattered in small environment? And, you know, our biggest competitors now are like not even the US anymore. It's China. It's blooming things like countries like India and Nigeria. Let's just try to stick together. I know we've tried not to trade together, and it's not been so cool before then. So if he was around, if he was able to have a strong speech, if he was even able to say, maybe I was wrong, you know, this kind of thing you wish some politician would say someday, suddenly it would bring a new breath of fresh air and we could have definitely a different discussion. It's, you know, it's the main party opposing the Prime Minister.
And we know that when he believes in a campaign, he's a phenomenal campaigner.
Exactly.
It's just he's terrible when
exactly.
he doesn't really.
That's
so
why,
I think,
you know, again,
energy.
I don't have British citizenship, so I've never been able, unfortunately, I wish someday to vote in for MPs elections. But I've always been a great admirer of his work as a campaigner along the years. I think, you know, he's proved many times that he was right on the war in Iraq, on other issues. And he supports the Palestinian. I think, you know, all the things we're not going to get there again, but about anti-Semitism, what's happening in the party and what's happening with Jeremy Corbyn are two different things. He is not an anti-Semite. But if he could be this strong person, embracing what happened this past 2 years and saying, listen, we're on the edge now and we need to just have a proper look at what's happening, that could definitely be a game changer.
Great. So, Ingrid, from Corbyn to who are you going to pick? Who are you going to turn?
Monsieur Farage. Yeah, I just, for me, he's the sort of symbol of all of this. I mean, obviously, anti-European movement started way before him, but he became the sort of totemic figurehead that people seem to rally behind. So if we could get him and his... I was going to say something rude about him, but I'm bigger than that. I was going to talk about his physical appearance. I'm not going to do that. But if we could get him to turn and come over to our side.
And bring all the golf club members with him.
I think people would, that would genuinely blow people's minds. Mm. That would be a big scalp, as it were.
Mm. And Roz, who are you going to pick out of the lovely bunch of Brexiters that we all so admire?
I'm going to pick Michael Gove. He's a dark horse, Michael Gove. As we know, he only narrowly decided to campaign for Brexit with Boris Johnson anyway. But since then, he's gone full Brexit and joined the European Research Group. So he's very influential, but he's always played his cards very carefully. And he doesn't come across as a hardcore, nutty Brexiteer.
Mm.
And that served him very well. But I think given that he is one of the bigger thinkers in the cabinet, which is not saying a lot, but it's saying something.
Everything's relative.
Everything's mm-hmm. relative. I think that he could have a profound influence.
Yeah. Great. So we've got Gove being very influential within cabinet. We've got Farage being influential with voters of a certain age and socioeconomic status. And we've got somebody who probably wouldn't bring the young people because they're already with us, but would maybe bring some of those backbenchers in the north that we absolutely need to make sure that they get on our side and help us defeat Brexit. I'm going to go for a lesser known MP, the MP for Eastbourne, Stephen Lloyd, who resigned the Lib Dem whip over Brexit a few months ago, because what the fucking point of being a Liberal Democrat MP is it if you're not even going to fight Brexit? So, yeah, I'd bring him. So, yeah, interesting that we've chosen four white men to try and turn towards the cause.
Shall we have them on the show if they all turn?
Oh, yeah, once they've turned, but definitely not before. Finally, we spend so much time with our heads in the Brexit fog that sometimes it's hard to step back and spot the truly big things that matter. So we're taking advantage of the lull this week to look at elephants in the room, the massive factors that ought to be in the Brexit debate but just aren't. So everyone's chosen one, and we're going to start with Ingrid. What's your elephant in the room?
My elephant in the room is Brexit men's fault? Now, obviously, I'm joking and I'm being deliberately inflammatory. Romaniac's clickbait headline. It was funny because, as you know, since Brexit, I consume information and sort of trying.
You were just a vessel.
Fairly
just
bovine. Like, well, yeah. just sitting on my sofa, scratching my pants. Doesn't even make sense. It's really interesting to me that, you know, more women voted Remain than men. I think the Ladies for Leave thing has sort of stirred something up in me again. It felt so wrong because, to me, Brexit is not a feminist endeavour. So the idea that these women are going, look, you need to talk, we need to speak up because it's what we believe in, is totally ludicrous. There was really interesting, after the Lord Ashcroft poll, immediately after the referendum result, that sort of examined why people, was looking at sort of slightly deeper reasons as to why people might have voted how they voted. And so they were asked questions about, you know, their ideologies and philosophies.
Yeah, the values.
Yeah, exactly. And someone on Twitter, the handle SupermassKid, pointed out that it wasn't just men who voted to leave, but it was people who consider feminism a force for ill in society by a factor of 3-1.
Wow.
So that's a fairly huge, I would say, a sort of damning indictment of Brexit and where it's come from as an impulse. Also, interestingly, I read that a lot of Brexiters have history degrees. A lot of the main ones, Rees-Mogg, Dominic Cummings, Boris Johnson, Daniel Hannan, Douglas Carswell, they all either studied history or classics, and as we know, history is peopled entirely by the achievements of men. And that is these sort of lone figures, these heroic figures. And a lot of the dialogue or the language that has been used around Brexit has been that sort of language.
Mm.
And that Giles Fraser article, I don't know if we mentioned this on the podcast, actually, I don't think we have, but the one, Giles Fraser wrote an article that was widely disseminated on Twitter about how, you know, a woman who'd rung up and said, what am I going to do about my elderly mother once all the EU care workers leave? And he thought, well, maybe we should go back to the values we had before we palmed off our elderly on EU care workers. But what he meant by that is, you know, when women would stay at home and look after their elderly parents, because that's who traditionally look after the ill and the infirm. And so it's, to me, that was just my thought. Obviously, I don't think hashtag not all men. A lot of the listeners of this podcast were going, what the? No, obviously not. But in the same way that it's a male problem, but it's a male problem in the sense of the things that we have conferred on men as sort of good attributes have got us into this mess.
So that demasculation that's felt by these pathetic creatures that sort of manifested in its...
Yeah, or this kind of idea of what is good and brave and noble, which is sort of looking back to a time gone by when women didn't have rights and migrants didn't have rights. And so that's funny, why they're scared. You know, people voted because they want to go back to that time, and I don't. And people, right-thinking people, shouldn't. But that's not to say that there aren't women who support Brexit. Obviously there are. And that's not to say there aren't many men who support Remain, because obviously there are.
But we need to deal with this issue.
As an issue, is it a male issue? That was all.
Thank you. Melissa, you've gone for peace and defence agreements. Who is even talking about what we'd do if China, North Korea and the US went mad? How would we all hang together in Europe?
Yeah, I can't believe it was never on the table during the campaign, after the vote. Starting with Northern Ireland, I mean, without the European Union, the agreement would never have been signed at a moment where, you know, it had been going on for so long. And now we've read articles saying that it's just bad for the people. I've been to Northern Ireland twice, talking about the border. I've been at the region there. It's just not going to work. And then what about the rest, as you said? So it's not, I don't want to have a bleak picture, but, you know, Europe is already at war. We don't mention it because it's not on our soil, but we've been involved heavily in what's happening in the Middle East. We've been involved in other regions. We're still contributing to some of the peacekeeping missions. We can't even say where we would stand as ourselves if anything happened, you know, in the Near East, North Korea, whatever. It's already difficult enough inside the EU to get all the countries to agree, because we've seen it with the war in Iraq. Like, Poland disagreed with France and the UK just went on to follow the US President George W. Bush anyway. So if we're not even talking about it, and if we're not in the same body politically, then what can happen? And I don't know. Why are we doing that? Why are we doing politics? Why are we being Europeans if we don't want peace?
And this is what I've always found so fascinating and frustrating about why Jeremy Corbyn isn't a bigger fan of the EU.
Exactly.
Because it is the greatest peace project in human civilization. And
it's just so obvious.
It is mad. And I think this point about, you know, you've got America being crazy under Trump, you've got China being increasingly aggressive in the East, and in the middle you've got this, you know, relatively stable liberal trading bloc that is actually crying out for the kind of leadership that Jeremy Corbyn could offer. So kind of almost back to your previous point about, you know, let's turn him and let's make him the person
it's all,
that
it's all
help.
Very related. It's like a domino game. Indeed. In my case, you know, you could just align all the stars and it would be a bright constellation of working politics.
Absolutely. Ros, your elephant in the room is electoral law. You know, nothing has changed in electoral law, campaign finance since the last referendum. Obviously, there's been a huge amount in the press about it, and the ability of Russia and its influence, particularly on social media. But we haven't put any new systems in place. Tell us about that. Why should we be talking about that more?
It matters enormously if there's a people's vote, because that is the kind of vote that Russia will try to influence. It also matters, of course, if there are European Parliament elections. Fingers crossed there are. I hope there are. But even if there aren't, there are local elections in May, and there may well be a general election. And yet, we haven't got to grips with the problems that have been thrown up by social media in elections. And we haven't rewritten our electoral law, which we badly need to do, to take account of social media, because it's just not a good fit anymore. Mm. The old model for campaigning doesn't fit. And we know this, but we can't yet acknowledge it because we're so busy with Brexit. And anyway, we don't want to look at it because it's embarrassing to think that we might have been hoodwinked. There was a report from King's College London that came out last week, and it was a very in-depth look at how much influence Sputnik and Russia Today, various pro-Kremlin outlets, had on
political discourse in various elections. And this findings were quite shocking to me, because it found that actually newspapers like The Sun and The Express and The Daily Mail had been copying and pasting, literally, stuff from Sputnik into their news articles. Mm. And it was only, it was only stuff about Russia's armaments and how much they had. But it shows just how willing the press is in this country to pick up on that agenda and to use that kind of copy. Mm. And this report didn't get much coverage. I wonder why. There are many, many ways in which Russia is spreading disinformation in our society now, and it will spread disinformation in new and innovative ways in whatever elections we have next. We don't even know how it will do it, but we haven't even caught up with the ways it did it last time yet. It's a moving target, but we have to try and hit it.
And this feeds into exactly what I think Melissa was saying, that the new war will be an information war. The way that we will fight one another will be through data. It will be through cybersecurity. It will be through the dissemination of fake news. And I think that the EU is now beginning to set up, under Macron, a pan-European organisation to look at this. And it's just terrifying that we wouldn't want to be on the inside of that.
Yeah, they've done that already to an extent. They already do quite a lot of trying to expose disinformation, but it's got quite a limited budget and it hasn't as yet been very effective. They are ramping it up for the European Parliament election.
Great, and we need to follow. My elephant in the room is the fact that the UK, and this again isn't a particularly well-reported stat, is that UK productivity growth over the last decade has been the worst since the 1860s. We weren't even this bad in the Great Depression. And so this is poor productivity growth. So when we talk about being tough on the causes of Brexit, not just Brexit itself, this is the sort of stuff that I'm talking about. I think that's absolutely outrageous. I think that austerity is the key factor in that. When we look at productivity, there are three factors of production. You've got land, labour and capital, traditionally. Some economists will dial in and argue, I'm sure, that there are others, but they're the sort of traditional three. And we've been squeezing the labour one more and more and more. And we've had stagnant wages. We've been putting more and more pressure on labour to be productive while allowing land and capital to go untaxed and unsqueezed. And I think that is all helping to contribute towards the sentiment of othering and blaming people who don't look and sound like us for the ills of our society. And I think it's absolutely outrageous that we're not talking more about that. And on that bombshell, that's the end of the show. And we're rumbling down the tracks towards us. We've got yet another thing to add in our Brexit time capsule. Ingrid Oliver, you haven't chosen anything in ages, so we're going to ask you again. What are you going to add this time?
Well, I've said the words today a few times already, and it's shame. Shame is going in the Brexit time capsule. I just wish there was, I'd like to get
Anyone
back to a time.
Some?
Yeah, I just wish we'd get back to a time. I miss the time when people would make mistakes and then be embarrassed about it and then resign. Apparently that's not a thing that people do anymore. So, yeah, bring back shame.
For this week's European language clip, we've got some Basque from listener Martin Digon.
Europan zehar, ze demontre gertatu zaigun Britaniarrei galdetzen ari dira. 2019 urtean, 3 urte luze eta gero, Brexiterokeri hau edo zein moduz geldi dezagun, Europar guztion onerako.
And that means all over Europe, they're wondering what the hell has happened to us Brits. In 2019, after 3 long years, let's stop this Brexit madness in any way possible for the sake of all of us Europeans. Excellent thinking, Martin. Remember, we always welcome your bits of European language. So whether you're fluent in Serbo-Croat, Walloon or Transylvanian Saxon, send us a short recording at info@romaniacs.com and we'll use the best ones. And that is the end of the show. Thanks to Melissa, Roz, Ingrid and producer Alex Rees as ever. Let's do the temperature check. Are we feeling a little bit more or less optimistic than last week, Roz?
Less optimistic.
More.
I'm feeling more optimistic every week. There's no other way.
I am always optimistic, so that's sort of no surprise there then. Sorry, Roz, but I'm sure you hope that we're right.
We're there for you.
We'll be back next week for more Brexit wars. And until then, here's our theme tune, Demon is a Monster by Corner Shop, and a salute to some of our amazing Patreon backers.
Bonjour et merci from me to Elliot Waters, Benji Aarons Richardson, Neil McCarty, Alistair McLean, Richard Ford, Martin Duncan and Tony Smollett.
Hello and thanks for your support from me to Declan Kelly, Ava Schuler, Naomi Winter-Vincent, Stephen Doyle, Neil Payne, Dominic O'Connor and Paul Richards.
Greetings and thanks to Stefan Buzarowski, Aidan Kurt-Elly, Eileen McLennan, Adrian Servitz, Andrea Ecker, Steve Bannister and Alex Winkle.
And hello from me to Mez Wahid, Will Clutton, Matt Sheard, Rob Binks, Debbie Canning, Louise Duggan and Michael Richard Ketley.
Romaniacs was presented by Naomi Smith with Roz Taylor, Ingrid Oliver and Melissa Shimam. The producer is Andrew Harrison and audio production was by me, Alex Rees. Romaniacs is a Podmasters production.